It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, we'll hear about challenges facing emergency service responders in rural Wisconsin. First, there are a record number of whooping crane nests in Wisconsin this spring. Conservationists have counted 31 nests, and the hope is that they'll translate into healthy chicks and a boost to the growing population of whooping cranes in the state. Whooping cranes verged on extinction in the 1940s because of hunting and habitat loss. 14 years ago, with only one whooping crane migratory flock left in the wild, conservationists in Wisconsin began releasing young cranes. Here to talk about how the chicks are faring this spring is David Lopez, whooping crane coordinator at the Department of Natural Resources. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, why are we seeing a record number of nests this spring?
Well, it's probably several factors. We actually are up to 37 nests now since that press release went out that had the 31 number. What we're seeing is birds that are maturing on the landscape. This is our record year. We've never had more than 30 nests before. We've had a lot of issues with nest abandonment due to a parasitic fly called the black fly that are specific to birds and are very concentrated on the Nisida National Wildlife Refuge, where the vast majority of our birds are the breeding birds are located. In the past, we've had a lot of nest abandonment before they were even able to bring the eggs to term and hatch the chicks out. This year, we're conducting some experiments forcing a renesting to see how successful the birds can be renesting. But for reasons probably related to the weather, this year has been a really low year for black flies, and so we've virtually seen no nest abandonment this year. So that contributes to the greater number of nests. Relatively speaking, these are very long-lived birds, and they live 20, 25 years, and a lot of times they don't start breeding until they're over 5 years old and maybe even up to 10 years old. And so as our population ages, we expect to see more and more breeders in the landscape, both in our previous release location in Nisida and then our new release locations up in Horicon and White River Marsh State Wildlife Area.
Are those the three places that you can find these nests, just Nisida, Horicon, and forget the third?
White River Marsh State Wildlife Area. We don't have any nests this year in Horicon or White River Marsh. We did have a nest in the White River Marsh area last year. We've kind of suffered from a loss of a lot of our females in that area, so there hasn't been a lot of pairing up so far. But that's very early in the releases up there. They're just 3 or 4 years old, most of the birds, so pretty young to be breeding and pairing up. So currently, the only places we have nests primarily are in Nisida, and then we have some scattered nests of birds that have moved around on their own and nesting in a few other counties around central Wisconsin.
Overall, how is the whooping crane population looking in Wisconsin?
Well, we've kind of hit a plateau over the last few years. We've been hovering right around 100 birds. We've gotten virtually no natural recruitment. It's so exciting about this year to see how many chicks we have in the landscape. And hopefully,
what does natural recruitment mean?
Natural recruitment is just when birds are hatched and then reared to fledging. Fledging meaning they can fly on their own. And to date, we've only had 7 birds that have been able to have been raised in the wild and have fledged successfully. So once it's fledged, they are much safer than they are when they're chicks, when they can't fly. So that's kind of when they enter the population is once they fledge, and we count them as part of the sort of adult population. So our population is hovering right around 100 birds. We've been supplementing it with our continued releases of captive-reared birds, but kind of just holding steady right now. We share the resources of released birds with another release project down in Louisiana, and there's only so many birds that go around from the captive centers. So we're really trying to rely on ramping up our natural reproduction to start to boost our numbers.
We're talking right now to David Lopez, whooping crane coordinator at the Department of Natural Resources, talking about the record number of whooping crane nests in Wisconsin this spring. And David, the chicks have started to hatch. That must be an exciting time. What do we know about how the chicks so far are doing?
Well, we only have they're doing really well. The first 2 weeks of their life is the most perilous for them, for sure. The vast majority of chicks that die in years past and in other populations have died in that first 2 years after hatching. But we have several chicks that are approaching that magical sort of two-week window. And we only have confirmed with lot the very first chick that was hatched, unfortunately, disappeared. We usually don't know what causes the disappearance. They kind of just vanish. probably due to predation. But of the remaining chicks, we have anywhere from about 9 to 12 chicks, a couple of those may be twins where there's two birds from one nest. And they all, you know, we do flights at least twice a week and try to monitor the status of the birds. And, you know, at last report, they're not always the easiest things to see, so that's why the little bit of uncertainty with the numbers. But so far, so good, and, you know, keep our hopes up on that.
How do you do the flights?
We just have pilots, primarily DNR pilots, but we also have contractors and people that donate planes to us that International Crane Foundation uses to do flights.
You just use binoculars and look down at the nest?
Indeed, binoculars, fly low, do circles, take pictures. Depending on the pilot, they can take a lot of pictures while they're doing it, and then go back to the office and try to identify chicks in the photographs. So basically, it's just going above a nest location. All the birds at one time or another had functioning radio transmitters, and if those transmitters are still functioning, they can pinpoint the location of the birds and also identify what bird it is. And then they'll just basically circle above the nest and try to get as much visual evidence of either eggs or chicks once they hatch.
Will there be more whooping cranes released in the fall?
Yeah, we plan on releasing another batch of whooping cranes, probably at least 13 birds. It's still a little bit uncertain in that captive centers that both at International Crane Foundation and the Patuxent Wildlife Research Center in Maryland are still coming online. There's still birds that are still eggs that are being incubated, so we're not 100% sure of how many birds, but we definitely will be releasing some birds this fall.
And what kind of numbers do you have in mind where you say if we hit this number and this benchmark, then we're looking at an upward trend?
Well, what we really need to see, you know, we have numbers in our recovery plan that are either 100 or if we're the only other reintroduced population, it'd be 125 birds and 30 breeding pairs. But really, that's kind of an arbitrary figure in that what we really need to be seeing is just a population increase. And the success of this project would be if we have a population that's stable or increasing without any further releases. So we're not there yet, and we're seeing signs and hopes, and it's a very slow process. Again, these are very long-lived birds, and so reintroductions like these take a long time. And but yeah, we would just like to see an increasing population without any further reintroductions, and that would be a great mark of success.
So that's Wisconsin we've been talking about. Do you have a sense of how whooping cranes are doing nationally?
Yeah, well, the only natural population that exists is the Aransas wood buffalo population that migrates between Texas and Canada. That's the only population that was never extirpated. So they're slowly increasing in numbers. They're at about 300 birds right now, and so that's a good sign. They do face challenges with water issues in Texas on their wintering locations. But they have continued to, with, you know, some ups and downs, continue to overall trajectory of increase. So that's very positive in the whole project. The idea of having a reintroduced population is key. That, you know, with any population, you don't want to have just one population of animals out there, in that a catastrophe or a disease outbreak could really decimate the population. So we'd like to have more than just those one populations, which is the idea of having these two ongoing reintroductions. There was a reintroduction of a non-migratory population in Florida that failed due to high adult mortality. We haven't had those issues, and then there's another population in Louisiana that's very young in its reintroduction, about 4 years in, and they're at about 30 birds right now, and that's a non-migratory population. So we have hopes for that Louisiana population. It's been doing well, but they're too young to really see much breeding at this point, and then with the continued growth of the wild population, you know, we're cautiously optimistic that there's a bright future ahead for the species.
Now, most of us know what sandhill cranes look like. They're getting a bit more common. What mm-hmm. do whooping cranes look like?
Well, they basically are shaped like a sandhill crane. They're a little bit taller and about, you know, maybe up to a foot taller than a sandhill crane. They're all white, and they have black and red on the tops of their heads. They frequently, if you see sandhill crane population, especially in central Wisconsin, it pays to kind of keep an eye out to see if you see a bigger white bird amongst them, because they do intermingle. But once you see a whooping crane, they're hard to identify in flight, and a lot of times we rely on a lot of public observations, and they can be confused with pelicans and other species, and it's even hard to tell them from a sandhill crane if the lighting's bad. But once you see one on the ground, you'll know you're seeing a whooping crane. They definitely stand out, the tallest bird in North America, and about 5 feet tall, and bright white.
Well, David, thanks a lot for joining us and telling us about it.
Yeah, you're very welcome. I'm glad to be here.
We've been talking to David Lopez, whooping crane coordinator at the Department of Natural Resources, talking about the record number of whooping crane nests in Wisconsin this spring that are starting just now to hatch. In rural Wisconsin, friends and neighbors often volunteer their time to provide life-saving care to people in their time of need. But as Daniel Kading reports, some emergency medical services are seeing fewer volunteers, and communities are struggling to come up with the money to provide care.
MMC, Med-2's en route, Red Cliff Intercept, patient complaining of chest pain.
Two paramedics head out from the Ashland Fire Department to help Red Cliff's volunteer EMS service with a patient.
We'll step out, grab our gear, and we'll climb into their ambulance, receive a report from the EMTs, and basically pick up from there.
That's Rain Ettinger. For the past 5 years, he's been paid to fight fires and help save lives in the Ashland area. That's not the case for Red Cliff's EMTs. Bayfield Mayor Larry McDonald says he was in a similar spot several years ago when he had a major heart attack.
Combination of Bayfield volunteer EMS and the Ashland paramedics doing their intercept is a big portion of what kept me alive.
McDonald believes he wouldn't have been so lucky if the local volunteers hadn't been there. Ashland Fire Chief Wayne Chenier says volunteers are vital to rural emergency services because his department can't meet every call for help.
We cover, 400 and some square miles for EMS and about a couple hundred for fire, and it is a challenge.
Ashland Fire's first priority is to the city and five nearby towns that pay for service, but paying towns like Eileen explored using the less costly volunteer services. Former chairman Terry Torco says close to half the town's levy goes to pay for emergency services each year, leaving less for road repairs and other services.
It became abundantly clear that our five towns have a problem, but there's a larger problem out there regionally in that the volunteer fire ambulance services are starting to decrease in numbers of volunteers.
Rural volunteer firefighter and first responder Adam Olson says one reason is that people are working long hours or two jobs. He says others shy away from the physical and emotional toll.
It's tough. It may not be easy going to a car accident at 11:30 on a Friday night in a rainstorm, but if we don't go, who will?
Lawmakers introduced a bill this month that would change a state requirement to have two licensed EMTs or similarly trained staff on an ambulance call. Ashland State Senator Janet Bewley says it allows a first responder like Olson to lend a hand.
The EMT is a level up, and it takes more time, more training. There are fewer of them. It just makes it harder to staff that call. This way, we're going to be able to make the best use of the time and energy that our volunteers are willing to commit.
In Washera County, EMS Director Brian Donaldson says the county and Wautoma subsidize a regional ambulance service that staffs ambulances at stations spread around the county. He says that cuts back on duplication of services and cost.
Rural EMS has really struggled because of the limited reimbursement on fees for service.
If we get paid, which is a big if.
That's Rob Poles, paramedic coordinator for Great Divide Ambulance Service in Bayfield County. He says they barely break even when patients are covered by Badger Care and some don't have insurance. To bring in more money, Great Divide provides patient transports for hospitals.
If we took that income away, I'm not really certain that our communities could afford to pay professional people, mixed people like we do now.
But Poles says they may have to find another way. He says more EMS providers are competing for patient transfers to keep their services going. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio in Superior.
State Senator Janet Bewley has been keeping an eye on the challenges facing rural EMS responders in the state, and she joins us now to talk about those issues and more. Senator Bewley, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what are the biggest challenges you see facing rural emergency responders in Wisconsin right now?
Fewer trained people and larger distances to cover. It's a way of life up there in the north. When everybody can think about going to the northern part of Wisconsin and you enjoy the great outdoors, but that's a lot of distance for emergency personnel to cover, and we depend upon volunteers to cover both the fire calls and the ambulance calls. And when we have fewer people who are able to volunteer, we have to figure out ways to cover the need.
Now, in the piece we just heard, some possible answers to the question of why those volunteer numbers are declining, long hours, maybe people working two jobs. Is that what you're seeing?
Absolutely. And then combine that with the fact that some of the counties in the north are ones that have a pretty high population of aging citizens. We're getting older in the north, and most of the younger people are either choosing to leave the area, they hold two jobs, they are just not in the same lifestyle that allowed their parents to be able to volunteer. We're having a hard time finding people who are willing to dedicate so much of their lives to a volunteer service.
What do you see as being at stake when volunteer numbers like that drop?
Well, of course, you know, the number one thing we want to do is make sure that people feel safe when they're in the North Woods, either because that's where you live or that's where you're vacationing. And right now, I want people to know you are safe. We have wonderful, a very high quality of both professional and professional volunteers. But we do know in the future it's going to get harder and harder to recruit the volunteers. So that's why we want to come up with innovative ways to be able to cover the calls. I'm talking now about ambulance calls, and one of the things we can do is to have the requirement that just one EMT and one first responder is on the call rather than two EMTs. The EMT is a requires a longer training period, and the first responders can certainly do their part while the EMT is handling the patient.
So what kind of training would you need as a volunteer if you're on that call?
Well, the EMT is
the volunteer, I should say.
The volunteer, the first level of a volunteer is a first responder, and that's a very basic course that you can take, and it takes, I believe, about 2 days of all-day training. It's hard work, and you've got to maintain your qualifications, and you have to be willing to be on call, to wear that beeper so that you can be a first responder. An EMT is one level up, and there is even more training, and you are required to, again, maintain that level of certification, and you, too, have to be on a beeper. There are more first responders than there are EMTs, and there are even fewer paramedics, the next one up. So if we can have one EMT, one first responder on an ambulance call rather than two EMTs, it will start to take some of the pressure off.
And you've supported that move. Where is that right now?
Well, it's been introduced as a bill. We're waiting for a hearing, and then once it's been heard and voted on, it could go to the floor. I wouldn't expect that to happen until the fall.
How urgent do you see this issue as being?
Well, I think that we know that this is going to become even more of a problem as our population ages and more people want to come to the north and enjoy the recreational opportunities. It's our responsibility that people are safe, and therefore it is our responsibility to make sure that we have the personnel to cover the calls.
And getting the people up there to fill these positions brings up a broader issue, and that is making Northern Wisconsin a place that young people want to come and live and to fill these roles.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing to encourage that?
We have to make sure that Northern Wisconsin has the kind of basic infrastructure that you can find in any other part of the state. And by infrastructure, I mean 21st century infrastructure, which is, of course, roads, but it's also communication and connectivity, having the adequate broadband speeds that people are used to in urban areas should be something that you should have automatically in the north. The same thing goes with quality schools and, again, emergency care. We need to make sure that people can enjoy the outdoors, but yet know that there's 21st century infrastructure holding up the communities that are there to serve them.
And some of these things you're talking about, the broadband and roads, these are issues that require money, and we're looking at, you know, a budget process that doesn't look to add a lot of things onto it like that, at least for right now. So do you see this as something that will become more and more of a pressing issue?
Well, it's going to become more and more of a pressing issue because you have to realize that we're starting from 20th century infrastructure in a lot of cases. I do not have cell phone coverage in my own home. When I go back to the district, I live in Delta. There are many areas that do not have broadband. Some people, and this is the truth, still depend upon dial-up. So, you know, there's a lot of issues that we need to correct just to get to where the rest of the state is. Now, if you begin to cut existing programs even more, we're not even going to get level with the state. We're going to continue to be falling behind. We need to get into the 21st century.
Do you find it challenging to get out there and make the case for northern Wisconsin when you have Madison and Milwaukee getting a lot of resources?
Well, I love doing what I do, and I think that we all have to acknowledge the fact that we're very proud of the Northwoods. We're very proud of living in an area that's a little different from the rest of the state. Yet at the same time, we need to make the case for the fact that just because there are trees and bears and deer up there doesn't mean that there shouldn't be broadband and cell phone coverage and emergency services as well. It's done in other states that have, you know, wilderness areas, and we should be able to figure it out too.
Senator Bewley, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
That was Wisconsin State Senator Janet Bewley talking about the issues facing rural emergency service providers in the state, particularly in northern Wisconsin. We're checking in on the latest news from the Joint Finance Committee. The legislature's Budget Committee met this week to take up changes to Governor Scott Walker's plan for Wisconsin's long-term care system for elderly and disabled people. Sean Johnson has been covering this story, and he's here to tell us the details. He's the state government reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Sean, welcome back.
Hi, Veronica.
Well, the biggest news so far, at least, out of the Joint Finance Committee this week is the decision to change the state's long-term care system. And let's start with Governor Walker's proposed changes. How did he want to overhaul the system?
Yeah, he wanted to make some pretty big changes to the system. And when we're talking about long-term care programs, we're talking about family care and IRIS, or the programs that have gotten a lot of attention. What the governor's plan would have done is he would have taken family care statewide. It's now available in more than 50 counties, but not everywhere. But at the same time, he would have turned it over potentially to a couple for-profit insurance companies to run as an HMO model statewide. And he would have ended the IRIS program. And the IRIS program is self-directed care, where people get a budget. Elderly and disabled people get a budget. They get to decide their own mix of long-term care. You know, they could spend that budget on somebody potentially to help them bathe or prepare a meal, or even could spend the budget to help them get ready to enter the workforce. It kind of is up to them. So that would have been gone under the governor's budget, and that's why at the public hearings on this plan, you heard IRIS participants, IRIS caregivers, and family members of disabled people saying, please don't do this. We like IRIS.
And why did the governor say that the system needed to change?
Initially, he didn't say much because it caught people by surprise. This wasn't something that came out of his own Department of Health Services. It's something that came as a directive of the governor. Eventually, he said that it was a cost-saving measure, that the state's Medicaid costs are eating up a larger piece of the budget all the time, and that these were proposals that were aimed at reducing those costs over the long term.
And that was, as you said, something that a lot of advocates of those who didn't want the programs to change, programs like family care and IRIS, they were advocating to leave things alone. Before we went into this Joint Finance Committee taking it up, what indication did they have about where the Joint Finance Committee was headed with it?
They were a little uneasy because Republican lawmakers said they were not going to support Governor Walker's proposal when it came to IRIS and family care. But they kind of left it open as to supporting elements of the governor's plan, you know, if not the entire plan itself. And I think if you look at what they did yesterday, there are obvious similarities to what the governor proposed with, I think, what Republican lawmakers would say are important differences, especially when it comes to IRIS.
Well, what did they decide?
Yeah, so they did go along with the governor on a statewide expansion of family care. They are going to have Governor Walker's Department of Health Services submit a waiver to the federal government for the chance to make pretty significant changes to the state's long-term care system. I think the biggest fundamental change could be that they would allow for-profit insurance companies to have a spot, a role in running the system. They also would, as part of that waiver, they would phase out IRIS eventually. And so that is something that IRIS advocates definitely did not want and were not happy with yesterday. But at the same time, they would direct the Department of Health Services to say, as part of your new system, we're going to have something just like IRIS. You're still going to have self-directed care, and you're still going to have choices. It'll be there whether or not it's called IRIS and is exactly the program we know today.
And what have advocates of leaving IRIS intact had to say about that?
I mean, they were pretty, downtrodden as they left the committee yesterday, the people that showed up to watch this. I think fundamentally for some of them, when you change the system to be partially run by for-profit insurance companies who have to make money off of it, they're going to make that money these advocates think is by reducing the amount of choices that they have right now, that there's no way a for-profit insurance company is going to give them the same range of options that they have right now when it comes to IRIS. So that's really kind of their biggest fear. And they had very strong words for the legislature yesterday, saying that they basically violated the trust of the public by not listening at these hearings. Again, this is something where Republicans pushed back and said, you know, this may not be IRIS, but we're asking the DHS to keep all the same stuff in whatever they develop.
And what's the case that Republican lawmakers on the JFC have made about how this is distinct from Governor Walker's plan?
I think that's the biggest one. Some of the other ones are that they would preserve some degree of regional control over the system. Right now, family care is chopped up into regions, the argument being that every part of Wisconsin is kind of unique in the way that it delivers its health care. There are, you know, big institutions in some of the parts of the state and not in other, and so it's always been chopped up that way. They would preserve some of that regional care. They would preserve what are known as aging and disability resource centers, where people who want to enter the long-term care system and get home-based care through family care or IRIS, instead of going into a nursing home, they check in there first, and that's kind of their gateway to the system. So that's still in there. Those are significant changes. But as far as kind of that sea change in the way that we run long-term care in Wisconsin, from not-for-profit groups, organizations making a lot of the calls to for-profit HMOs, that's still in the plan that passed the Joint Finance Committee.
We're talking with WPR state government reporter Sean Johnson, talking about the JFC's decisions yesterday regarding Wisconsin's long-term care programs. And Sean, these changes have not been affected yet, it's not finalized, but what do we know about how people's coverage or programs could change?
And well, until any kind of this proposal that they have to put before the federal government, this waiver proposal, until that's approved, this stuff isn't going to go away. I mean, the program will operate as is for the time being. However, there is a budget cut associated with this. The governor's budget and the budget that passed the Finance Committee yesterday does ask for the state to find some kind of savings within these programs, doesn't really specify how, and also that the changes that they're proposing to the system don't actually come with any associated cost savings. I mean, the Fiscal Bureau didn't put a number to them and say, here's how much you're going to save by moving to this system. We don't know. We don't know that it's going to save the state. The thinking is that it will save the state long term, but there's no hard numbers to attach to that.
Now, before we let you go, let's just touch on a couple of the other things that JFC covered yesterday. One included local room taxes. What was that about?
That came out of nowhere. It was the very end of the Finance Committee. as these proposals sometimes come out. And essentially, it would give local governments less power over how to use their own room taxes. Instead of making that call on their own, it would be turned over to a board. Some question over how that board would look. And from Madison in particular, lawmakers were really worried that these changes would endanger the way that they spend their room tax dollars, especially on operating Monona Terrace.
And they also talked about earmarked taxpayer money for private building projects. What happened there?
Yeah, they added a couple of things to the Building Commission budget that were not there before. So a few weeks ago, they took this Eau Claire Confluence project out of the budget. The governor had put it in there, a $15 million investment from the state for this project in Eau Claire. They took it out a few weeks ago. Yesterday, they put it back in but instead of paying for it with state tax money all up front right away, they put it in the Building Commission budget, so they're going to bond for it. They're going to borrow for it, which is the way that state typically pays for these building projects. They also approved money for a chemistry building at the UW-Madison, which is something that didn't make it through the Building Commission process, but something that very early on a number of majority Republicans said they wanted to see. And this is also something that Democratic lawmakers like too in Madison.
And in a way, the week is still young in the sense that there are still a lot of really big issues left on the table, only one day left in the week. But what are some of those big issues that still have to be taken up by the JFC?
Yeah, most of them, really. I mean, at the beginning of the week, kind of made a list of everything that was coming up yet and said these should all be done by the end of the week. These should all be resolved if everything goes as planned by Friday. And we've gotten one of them out of the way now with long-term care. We still have the University of Wisconsin and the governor's $300 million cut there. What's going to happen there? We still have this Milwaukee Bucks arena deal, which is starting to shape up, but nothing's final yet. We still have the Department of Transportation budget and a bunch of borrowing there that lawmakers don't like, but they don't know what they're going to do instead. And now we've got this fight over prevailing wage that's created quite a rift among Republicans, with conservative media urging Republicans to completely repeal Wisconsin's prevailing wage law for government construction projects, and Republican legislative leaders saying, look, we don't have the votes. So it's not, I wouldn't be surprised, even though they're scheduled to take all this stuff up tomorrow, it's kind of looking like it's not going to wrap up tomorrow and that it might go into the weekend or even next week.
Sean will be watching. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR state government reporter, who's with us to talk about the Joint Finance Committee's decisions on changing Wisconsin's long-term care program for the elderly and the disabled. We're taking a look at a new report out today from the Public Policy Forum on marijuana citations in Milwaukee. Right now, the Common Council is considering a reduction to the fine for first-time possession of small amounts of marijuana. The report looks at whether or not lowering that first-time possession fine will help address some larger problems, too many people behind bars, and a drain on law enforcement resources. Rob Henkin is with us. He's the president of the Public Policy Forum who put out that report. Rob, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, what were you hoping to get at with this new report?
Well, the driver for this report was the emotion and hyperbole that often surrounds public policy deliberations about marijuana. And this is an issue that obviously has received national attention. It's received attention in many state capitals. And increasingly, it's also receiving a great deal of attention in municipalities across the country. Here in Milwaukee, there is a proposal, as you mentioned, before the Common Council that would dramatically reduce the fine associated with a first-time offense. And one of the real rationales for wanting to go in that direction is the notion that the fine, which right now is $250 to $500, is onerous and is resulting in lots of disadvantaged people actually having to spend time behind bars because they cannot afford the fine. And we're not taking a position as to whether that's a correct rationale or not, but we wanted to look into whether, indeed, if the fine were to be lowered, whether there would be an impact in terms of incarceration rates. Interestingly, what we found is that in terms of these first-time offenses, those who are unable and or otherwise failing to pay the fines, for the most part, are not being put behind bars. There are other avenues that are being taken to try to collect. But for the most part, the bigger problem, if you're worried about incarceration, is really the treatment of second and subsequent offenses for possession of small amounts of marijuana.
And before we dig in to more of the details, what legal authority does the city of Milwaukee have when it comes to setting marijuana policy? Isn't this more of a federal issue?
Well, it's a great question. And so first of all, you know, people often get confused because many are aware that under federal law, marijuana is classified as a Schedule I drug, which means that its possession or use is prohibited. But we all know there are states that have carved out their own legal frameworks. Washington State and Colorado, of course, the most prominent, that have fully legalized marijuana. Here in Wisconsin, marijuana possession and usage is indeed prohibited under state law, but state law also affords municipal governments the ability to develop their own ordinances when it comes to first-time offenses for possession of 25 grams or less. So the city of Milwaukee has indeed in 1997 availed itself of that opportunity. And so in the city of Milwaukee, for again, that first citation for 25 grams or less with no intent to distribute, that is considered a municipal violation akin to a parking ticket. But there is a pretty hefty fine. Again, $250 to $500 plus other assorted court fees can make it even bigger than that.
So as it stands now, what happens when somebody hits that second offense?
So the second offense does become a violation, a criminal violation, and so it is considered by the district attorney under state law. And for that second offense, that is to be considered a misdemeanor, and a third and subsequent offense can be charged as a felony, though the district attorney also has discretion to be able to prosecute a third and subsequent as a misdemeanor. But either way, the big difference between a civil violation and a criminal violation is that even if it is a misdemeanor, it appears on one's criminal record, an arrest is made, there may be time spent in jail awaiting disposition by the district attorney and the court, and so it is certainly rises to another level of severity as opposed to a municipal citation.
And so what happens if you flip that around and the second violation stays municipal and does not become a criminal violation?
So it's an interesting issue because there are trade-offs there. So on the one hand, just looking at it from the perspective of the individual, certainly the treatment as a municipal violation would be a good thing in that while there would be a record of the violation in the municipal court database, it's not in the databases that are typically searched by employers and others when they're seeking information on one's criminal record. So there's not going to be a record of that. Again, ostensibly, an arrest is not going to be made. Simply a ticket would be issued. On the other hand, there are many cases where second and subsequent offenses, for whatever reason, are not prosecuted. And so in this case, somebody would have to pay a fine who otherwise ostensibly would not have been prosecuted for the criminal violation and essentially would have gotten off without having to pay anything.
We're talking right now with Rob Henkin. He's president of the Public Policy Forum, talking about a new report on marijuana policy in Milwaukee. And Rob, looking at possibly the option of making that second violation a municipal violation, is that, in effect, one step closer to legalizing marijuana?
Well, there's sort of a range here that goes all the way from prohibition on the one hand to full legalization on the other. And really what we are talking about here is not legalization, but decriminalization. So again, putting small or offenses related to possession of small amounts, typically in private places, as similar to a parking ticket as opposed to a criminal offense. Now, I should also note that according to a new provision in the Wisconsin statutes that was actually adopted just last year, municipalities now do have the option of treating second and third possession offenses for 25 grams or less as municipal violations, but only if the district attorney elects not to prosecute. So an arrest would still have to be made, but the state legislation did carve out some greater opportunity for more of these offenses potentially to be treated as municipal violations.
And is that option being exercised very often?
Well, so far, no. And we took a look at the Milwaukee County municipalities. Only West Allis of the 19 municipalities in Milwaukee County has changed its ordinances to conform to the new state statute. The ordinance change that is before the Milwaukee Common Council, while it would lower the fine dramatically, it would not at this point take advantage of that new provision of state law.
And you looked at racial differences in marijuana possession offenses. What did you find there?
So we have not yet conducted the exhaustive analysis that we plan to conduct in the second phase of our research, but we did take a look just at those individuals who were prosecuted by the district attorney in a recent two-year period for a second and subsequent offense of marijuana possession only. And we found that 86% of the individuals who were convicted in those 2 years were African American. So there may be all sorts of reasons for that, and we're not seeking to put any value judgment, but in terms of a racial disparity, you compare that 86% to the fact that African Americans comprise about 26% of the Milwaukee County population. And so there's a disparity there that obviously deserves a closer look.
So if you look at Milwaukee having the highest rate of incarceration for African-American males in the country, and you look at your results from your report, does the report suggest an effective route toward reducing that number?
We don't go that far, but again, I think that for those, and let me point out, we are a nonpartisan policy research organization that did not undertake this analysis to advocate for any point of view on this. That being said, if indeed you wanted to have an impact on incarceration of African-American males, looking very specifically at marijuana policy, our review of the data would indicate that the place to look is the treatment of these second and subsequent offenses for small amounts of marijuana.
And with the Common Council weighing a reduction in the first time possession fine, does that seem to be an effective route based on what your report suggests?
So I think there's all sorts of reasons why one might want to consider lowering the fine. Again, if the only rationale for wanting to do it was to keep African-American males out of prison, our analysis shows this wouldn't be that effective because we're not sending people to prison for these violations right now anyway. That being said, again, there are many other reasons to do it, and our scan of municipalities across the country that are changing their policies to get at issues like racial disparities and who are interested in redirecting law enforcement resources to other higher priorities have gone the route of expanding the universe of violators who would be subject to municipal citation as opposed to criminal violation.
Rob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
That was Rob Henkin, president of the Public Policy Forum. He was with us to talk about their new report on marijuana policy in Milwaukee.